Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Oncology Q&A, discussing common questions posed by patients with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. We're doing this program in conjunction with the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation and Ms. Haley Dimmerman. And we have a great faculty today. We have a number of docs who are participated in a survey that you'll see. And also we have Dr. Lisa Carey from the University of North Carolina, Dr. Rita Nanda from the University of Chicago. This is really the second of a two-part program. We actually worked with Drs. Nanda and Carey in November, and we did the first program, which was targeting patients. And today we're going to do this program with similar content, but targeting healthcare professionals, particularly oncologists, but also nurses, I know will be attending here today. As is always the case in our programs, we will be talking about the use of non-approved agents and regimens. So check out the official prescribing information for each product that we talk about today. So I met actually with eight patients, women, who had metastatic triple-negative breast cancer in individual Zoom interviews. I asked them what are some of the questions that they've had or they think patients have that they'd like to see addressed. And we're going to hear it right from them in terms of some of the things they want to hear about. We'll show how the six investigators, including our faculty, responded to some of those questions. We also are going to use this as an opportunity to provide a sort of an update of some of the things that happened in San Antonio. And in particular, it was a really great, actually 90-minute education session in San Antonio on antibody drug conjugates in breast cancer, including triple negative breast cancer. I was just fascinated by this symposia. I pulled out a few of the slides for the faculty to talk about. And we'll also talk about, there wasn't a whole lot of ground earth-shaking data presented for metastatic triple-negative disease. But we'll talk a little bit about that as we move forward here today. We also are going to include some video from a program we did also on metastatic triple-negative breast cancer in November. This was with the Florida Cancer Specialists. So you'll see these eight women presented in a silhouette to protect their anonymity, and also Dr. Mayan Hussein, who was part of the Florida Cancer Specialist program we did. We pulled a couple of comments from him to see what you all think about it. This is our playlist for today. We're going to show nine videos, each one about 1 minute, so just a little sampling. You know, what we're going to talk about today will really be of interest to a wide variety of people. I think some of the basic clinical pearls will be of great interest, particularly we know about 30% of our audience is pretty new to oncology, so we always like to keep them in mind, and we want to have our faculty chat a little bit about this disease and this situation from people who haven't seen it that much. But also, as I mentioned, we're going to get into a bunch of things that happened in San Antonio that we think you'll find of interest. So we're going to start out with a patient video. And this, again, all these women had metastatic disease. Here's one of the comments from the first patient.
When I found it was metastatic breast cancer, I really went into a really bad place. I really honestly thought that it was a death sentence as in like, you know, months. My husband, he didn't help as far as my emotional side went because he would get so upset and then I would get upset.
So Lisa, again, imagine you're making rounds with a couple of fellows who maybe haven't seen a patient with metastatic breast cancer. You see a patient on your schedule, metastatic triple negative breast cancer, first diagnosed. We know this could be a patient with de novo disease, as a couple of these women were, or more likely having previously received adjuvant therapy. What are some of the things from the, you know, the global patient point of view and family point of view you're thinking about as you get ready to walk into that room?
Yeah, you know, with any metastatic patient newly diagnosed, whether it's de novo or recurrent, I have to say the first thing that I want to make sure is they understand the goals of therapy. Like, what are we trying to accomplish? Because it's a very different paradigm than the curative intent. And I want to make sure that they're, you know, kind of along the journey to understand that, you know, we will make every effort to palliate their disease and we will keep their quality of life front of mind. You know, when I talk to patients, usually not in the very beginning, but later on, you know, I try and say, what frightens you the most? Because I think that can be a very helpful thing to ask them. That requires a certain level of therapeutic relationship that you have to have had. So it may not be if you're just meeting a patient, but basically trying to figure out where they are and trying to also help them understand what the goals are.
So Reed, any thoughts? I mean, this overwhelming feeling that the patient just described, I think is true of pretty much every patient. And I guess one thing too is to see what kind of support the patient has. In this case, the husband was just as disturbed as the patient was. What are some of the things you're looking for, again, when you see these patients for the first time?
I mean, I think, you know, what Lisa said is spot on. And I think the other things that I think are very important is this is such an overwhelming time for patients. They've just been diagnosed with a life-threatening and life-altering illness. The support system is obviously huge, but also making sure that they have resources outside of their family. So like psych oncology, social work, support groups, if that's something that they're interested in, I think are very important. And I think it's also very important to offer patients hope. You know, that there are treatments, that we have made improvements, and there are a lot of things that we're going to try, that there's never a promise or a guarantee that a treatment we're going to give them is going to help, but that we will continue to try different therapies and that there are new therapies coming out all the time. And so I think that's a really important component of, you know, talking to patients. Absolutely, we need to set the expectation that this is not generally a curable disease, but that we do have therapies that can help them live longer and better.
Yeah, can I add one thing quickly to that,
sure.
Neil? I think, you know, asking the patient who their posse is really important, but also letting them know that there are, you know, psycho-oncology and other things that can help them, because nobody's equipped to handle these things on their own. And giving them permission to ask for help, I think, is really important.
Yeah, that's a great point. And here's another patient. Rita, maybe you can respond to this. Because on top of trying to digest, you know, concepts like the goals of therapy, et cetera, there's specific information that you want the patient to have. We asked this patient, from her point of view, what are the things that she was most concerned about? And here's what she said.
Anything you'd want to hear more about?
Biggest thing is possible side effects. What should I experience when I do this? And then things like pre-meds. Sometimes they don't tell you what your pre-meds are. You have to ask. And, you know, they're just hanging bags and giving you things to swallow, and they haven't told you what it is you're taking. But yeah, what should I expect? Because you just don't know.
Rita?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. We do give pre-meds for all of the therapies. You know, I don't generally go through every single pre-med. I do it in more vague terms. We're going to give you a treatment 30 minutes before you get your infusion to help with the side effects. And you're going to go home with these additional medications that you'll take. We always give a little printed handout or send it through my chart of all the medicines that they're going to take, when they should take them, and what they're for. But I agree with pre-meds. A lot of times, you know, I don't go through that, but our infusion nurses do on the day of, like, here's your Benadryl, here's your steroid, this is what it's for. And in general, when I spend a lot of time talking to patients, I spend a lot of time talking about the side effects of therapy and what we're going to do to help mitigate some of those side effects.
So just to integrate a couple of the questions we asked the faculty here, one, because just to show you the spectrum of answers that people give, we asked for, you know, today we're going to really be emphasizing ADCs. We're not going to talk that much about PARP inhibitors or IOs, et cetera. ADCs is really a very hot topic nowadays. But one of the things we always ask is, what's the chance a patient's going to have the drug held because of toxicity? You can see the variation in numbers based on people's experience in their reading of the literature. Also, the chance that the drug actually is going to have to be discontinued, which, of course, is unusual but not rare in the drugs used in this situation as well. Lisa, I'd like you to comment on this patient's thoughts. This is a very common scenario of a patient who's been through adjuvant therapy, maybe didn't quite pick up or blocked out, you know, some of the potential things that might happen in the future, and then ended up having recurrent disease. Here were her thoughts.
I'd went through chemo for 4 or 5 months. Then I had the double mastectomy. And then it was like, I was done. You know, they told me I was good. And so I really just didn't think I'd ever get it back. I mean, I really didn't. So this time was more of a shocker to me, really, because I had done all this stuff and it come back. And I still have a hard time with it. I just can't believe it. Honestly, I mean, I had the impression I would be fine. And I just had no worry in the world for those 3 years.
Lisa, any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I think this harkens back to making sure that we're very clear with patients about what we're trying to accomplish and the limitations of what we can do and the reasons that we do follow patients after their diagnosis in order to do, you know, some element of surveillance, because the cancer can come back even if they've had the very best therapy. And, you know, as Rita said, you know, we're getting better and better all the time, right? In our neoadjuvant and adjuvant setting, we're clearly curing more people than we were before. But not everybody. And, you know, if you, you know, she went through neoadjuvant therapy, if she had residual disease afterward, then she had a fairly high risk of recurrence. It is incumbent on the team to make sure that we don't scare people too much, but that we also are honest that there is a risk and there's a reason that they need to stay in touch with their care team.
So, again, back to, you know, you brought up the issue of screening. This patient didn't have any screening and was told that it really wouldn't make a difference in the long run, and yet you can hear her disappointment. And, in fact, most of the faculty doesn't use a routine imaging and blood work. Also, another question we asked Rita, just related to metastatic disease, was the issue of oligometastatic disease in local therapy. And most of the faculty will use that strategy on occasion. Anything you want to say about that? Including surgery on the breast, Rita?
Yeah, I mean, I would say in general, we have data that removing the primary tumor doesn't improve long-term outcomes. However, I have over the years had patients who, you know, their distant disease is under control for years and then their primary starts to grow. And so those are cases where on a case-by-case basis, I will consider local therapy and then continuing their systemic therapy with their, you know, visceral mets under control. But in general, we do not do surgery. We do not do radiation to the primary tumor, you know, in the setting of de novo metastatic disease, even if it's oligometastatic.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Go ahead, Lisa.
No, I was just saying I agree with that. I mean, there are randomized studies that are, you know, disappointing that in the routine setting that treating oligometastatic disease comprehensively actually helps the patient. And in some cases, particularly triple negative, may hurt the cause. And so, you know, I think we, in the setting of symptomatic disease or local progressive events that have compression or symptoms, then I think absolutely. But outside of that, no.
So usually it doesn't take very long, but here it is from our chat room. Thoy, Rita wants to know, what about ctDNA? For patients post-adjuvant therapy. Is that something you think is useful now or maybe in the future?
Potentially in the future, but in right now in 2024, now 2025, it is not something I'm routinely doing outside of a clinical trial. I think it's hard to know what to do with the information. And so unless we have data that tells us detecting a cancer by ctDNA before it's clinically apparent on imaging and doing something with that information helps patients in the long run, I think it's hard to want to do that, because then it's what do we do with the information? And probably about half of patients who have ctDNA positivity will actually have visible disease on imaging. So I think right now where that is not something that I'm doing as part of my practice outside of a trial. But I think down the road, if we know what to do with the information, and we can show that, you know, detecting ctDNA positivity before clinically apparent disease, and we do something about it, impacts outcomes, then by sure, that could be a practice-changing situation. But we do not have that data yet.
So in talking to these eight patients, of course, one of the big issues that came up was tolerability, side effects from treatments. And this next patient brought up, I thought, a really interesting point that I'm sure you hear a lot, and I'm curious what your thoughts are sort of from both from a scientific as well as a clinical point of view, which is the question, do you start out at the optimal dose or do you start at a lower dose and go up and escalate up as opposed to go down? Here's the viewpoint of one patient and also Dr. Hussein.
The beginning few cycles were difficult. I guess there's a standard dosage that they start everyone out with. And I was having very bad side effects from it. And so she was able to eventually lower the dosage to where it became tolerable and I could sustain the side effects. I know that there's a level that they want everyone to start with, but if they know that 90% of the people that are on this dosage can't tolerate it and they have to lower it, why not start at a lower dosage so that people don't get discouraged and don't want to continue on with treatment?
Those patients, we know it's palliative. So the question is, how can I balance the toxicity with making sure the patients still have quality of life? Is it worth it to really try, you know, go with full doses first, or should I adjust? Do I feel guilty going lower? And then now we have more than one option of ADC. So how do I sequence those? The way when I manage advanced, any cancer, advanced stage, I use that example of like a baseball manager. I have a certain number of pitchers. I know I'm probably going to have to use them all. So I want to try to use them wisely.
So, Lisa, any thoughts first about this dose question and also in terms of, you know, I love the baseball analogy, but trying to figure out sort of what's the batting order, so to speak?
I like the baseball analogy. You know, I think it's a great question. The reality is that dosing of anti-cancer drugs is, you know, was not very rationally defined in any of their cases, right? We go to maximum tolerated, then you back off by one. And so we know that we overtreat a lot of people. And we also know that there's a lot of inter-individual variability in metabolism and how they tolerate these drugs. I have to say, I'm perfectly comfortable with doing either starting at a lower dose and escalating, or, you know, having a fairly low threshold for dose reductions. Again, for dose reductions, I know that we're overtreating a lot of patients simply because we go to MTD minus one, basically. And for escalation, you know, I think there are patients who are scared to death of the side effects and you want to kind of bring them along. And, you know, usually you can escalate relatively quickly. If they're tolerating, they'll come back and say, that was easy. And then you're off to the races. There are others that are scared to death of getting anything less than maximum. And so you start as high as you can and then say, listen, let's make a deal. We know that these aren't rationally or biologically effective doses. They're just maximally tolerated doses minus one. And we'll make a deal that if you have a hard time, we're going to go down, but we'll start at the highest you can tolerate. There's a lot of patients who just have very different viewpoints on this.
Rita, any thoughts?
I mean, I think it's an interesting question. And I would say in general, unless I have a patient who's got some issue that I think they're not going to be able to tolerate the sort of starting dose, like thrombocytopenia or, you know, other challenges, you know, performance status, then I will start at a lower dose. But in general, I do start at the starting dose, but very quickly de-escalate. And I think the way I think about this is, not everybody's going to respond to every therapy. And, you know, every patient is different. And some patients need dose adjustments and other patients don't need dose adjustments. And so I don't want to be in a situation where somebody's not responded and it's because I didn't start at a good dose when they potentially could have tolerated the traditional starting dose. So I generally start, with some exceptions, at the recommended starting dose, recognizing that there are many patients who are going to have side effects, but then have a very low threshold for reducing the dose, particularly in the metastatic setting.
Yeah, I thought Dr. Hussein's comment about feeling guilty, exactly what you were saying, if the patient progresses, did you really give them the optimal therapy? And kind of a related question that we asked is about the issue of dose reduction. If the dose of treatment is reduced, so what data do we have about whether it's equally effective or not, or whether or not it's less effective? And it looks like for some of the common agents, particularly ADCs and PARP inhibitors, there's a general feeling, Lisa, that by reducing the dose, you're not compromising efficacy. But what data do we really have to address that question, Lisa?
We don't have a lot of data in the metastatic setting. I think, you know, I think most people, and the reason most people said no is that we all know how these doses were determined, which was not as a biologically effective dose. And so I think people feel fairly comfortable that they're starting max, and so reducing probably is unlikely to create a lot of difficulty. Even in the adjuvant setting, you know, until you get, you know, 80% or so off, you don't start to see a decrement in treatment effectiveness.
So I want to go on to the next video talking about tolerability issues, particularly as it relates again to our main emphasis here, antibody drug conjugates. Here are a couple of patients reflecting on their experience, one with the antibody drug conjugate sacituzumab and the other a patient with HER2 low disease who got trastuzumab deruxtecan.
I was having diarrhea with the Trodelvy, which was kind of disheartening because, you know, I was hearing all these great things about it, and I was really excited to get on that drug, knowing it was something for triple negative patients. I think we did reduce the dose at one point, but I got 2 years out of it, so I can't complain too terribly.
I actually had a tumor on my neck, and so it was really restricting my ability to do any daily functional business. And since I've started the Enhertu, it's shrunk like almost completely away. And so I'm getting back to being more me.
Any side effects from the treatment?
I have a lot of nausea with this treatment. Mm-hmm. It's almost the full 3 weeks in between treatment that I'm nauseous instead of just a few days.
So, of course, now we're starting to hear this from all through oncology, not just breast cancer, as T-DXd is approved and IHC 3+. But going back to sacituzumab, Rita, two big concerns. One, this patient mentioned, although she was able to receive it for 2 years, that initially she had a problem with diarrhea. I'd like to know how you approach that preventively and therapeutically, and also, of course, cytopenias and whether you use growth factors preemptively.
Yeah. So in terms of diarrhea, you know, obviously antidiarrheal agents are the cornerstone of therapy. You know, I will have to say I don't see a ton of diarrhea with sacituzumab govitecan. You know, I've had a couple of patients here and there, but most are able to tolerate it. If anything, I run into more the cytopenias. But if someone's having terrible diarrhea that's really hard to manage with, you know, antidiarrheal agents, then I will do a dose reduction. For neutropenia, I generally will incorporate growth factor. If they're having both, then obviously I'm going to dose reduce. So a lot of it has to do with what side effects they're having and how bad they are. I do not preemptively use growth factor for these patients. I do a more wait and see. And if patients look like they need growth factor, I will give it. If they are having diarrhea and neutropenia, then many times I'll just reduce the dose. So it really depends.
And we asked our faculty panel about growth factors preemptively, and a couple people said yes, but most said kind of what Rito just was reflecting. The other thing, and this was brought up by Dr. Hussein, and it's a generally big issue in general, particularly in HER2-positive disease, which is sequencing of therapy, particularly sequencing of ADCs. And we get in a second to the seminar they had. They got into the whole issue of resistance to ADCs. But Lisa, at least in terms of ADCs, which often comes after, you know, conventional chemotherapy with anthracyclines and taxanes, when T-DXd is an option in HER2-low patients, we still see the faculty going with sacituzumab first, and including yourself. What's the thinking behind that preference, Lisa, in any situations where you would do T-DXd first?
Yeah, I mean, I think the background is that there are just a lot more data with sacituzumab in the triple negative setting. And so people are, you know, more comfortable with the, you know, likely benefit and the risks. You know, and because of that, it's, you know, kind of reached for. The rest are much smaller subsets of the existing trials. Now, you know, the truth is, as was just alluded, the side effect profile is very different between the two, not, you know, you may have a lot more cytopenias, you have more diarrhea with sacituzumab, you have more nausea, you have the risk of ILD, and you have alopecia. But so you know, some of the decision making may fall at the level of you know, kind of the concerns for side effects that some patients may be particularly prone to.
So, Rita, you heard the patient talking about having a lot of nausea and vomiting with the TDXD, which is something we've been hearing a lot about, a lot more sensitivity to that. How do you approach preemptively in terms of patients who are going to get TDXD? And any situations when you have a patient like this who just really doesn't feel well for all 3 weeks where you would extend it out to every 4 weeks?
So what I have found, and there are some great data about using low-dose olanzapine of 2.5 milligrams daily, and that has been game-changing for my practice with TDXD. Before we had those data, I would routinely have patients I'd have to bring back a week out from chemo, give them more fluids, IV antiemetics to kind of get them through. But the low-dose olanzapine, 2.5 milligrams, has been really wonderful for patients. So that has been great. In terms of the patients not feeling well, you know, I'd probably reduce dose before I would increase, you know, like give them an extra week off. I would consider reducing the dose at that point if they're really feeling terrible.
That's a great point. So anyhow, I really appreciate the faculty's willingness to go along with stuff last minute. I sort of sprung this thing about the ADC education program, but I work with both of them before, so I guess I hope they trust me. But anyhow, I was just riveted by this 90-minute program that they had there at San Antonio, and I really recommend you all to check it out and watch the whole thing. It's organized by Dr. Tarantino from Dana-Farber. But I feel like we talk about ADCs all the time, and yet I learned so much. I can't even begin to get into it. I just picked out a few of my favorite slides along the way just to see what the faculty thought. And again, I appreciate their thoughts and sort of the impromptu nature of it. So one thing that came out that I guess I didn't really exactly appreciate, Rita, was like how quickly things are accelerating in terms of ADCs. I actually remember right before the IOs came out, it was like everybody was all excited about ADCs. And then the IOs came out and immunotherapy was so compelling. And, you know, we were starting to see some cool stuff. But yet, when you really look at it, I mean, the last 5 years, you've had 8 approved new ADCs. You have metastatic bladder cancer now with enfortumab, with pembrolizumab, first line therapy, beating out cisplatin. And I guess TDM1 in breast cancer was the first ADC, and that wasn't approved until 2013. And of course, I think it was 2019 that the Catherine trial came out that had such a huge impact on HER2-positive disease. We'll talk a little bit later about all the research going on there. But Rita, anything you want to say about this incredible revolution that seems to be happening right in front of us?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you were right on, Neil. You know, the last 10 years, everybody was all excited about immunotherapy and how it was transforming the care of all these different types of cancers. Over 20 different types of cancers have immunotherapy now available for use. And I think the next 10 years are going to be all about ADCs, you know, newer ADCs, newer targets, newer toxic payloads. And I think it's really exciting. They're poised to really displace traditional chemotherapy.
I feel like I'm the reviewer of a Netflix movie on ADCs that was 90 minutes long, but I really recommend it. And so here's a quick look at the ADCs currently approved in metastatic breast cancer. Of course, we had TDM1 first and TDXD, which of course beat out. Interesting, they were pointing out same target or, you know, antibody, trastuzumab, but yet much better effect when you add the different payload and then sacituzumab. And then a bunch more coming along the line, particularly TROP2 ADCs, where we'll talk about the fact that it doesn't seem like there's that much correlation with ADCs. With the level of TROP2, we have datopotamab deruxtecan and sacituzumab timorelekin. I just call it SAC-TMT. Any thoughts about where we are right now, Lisa, and where you think things will be heading with some of these newer agents?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a little bit of more of a jaundiced view about this. You know, I think for many years, the excitement was around targeted therapy in triple negative breast cancer, and it wasn't as easy, right? It turns out that triple negative is harder to drug with, you know, EGFR inhibitors and all. I mean, the kind of traditional targeted therapies that folks were very excited about. Now, these are ways of taking chemo, which has never gone away and has always been effective in triple negative breast cancer, and making it smarter. But we have to recognize the limitation of that being the fact. And so what I would say is two things about the existing ADCs. We're relying a lot on TOPO1 inhibition, and I am very much looking forward to getting past TOPO1 inhibitors and a little bit of tubulin-directed drugs and to really novel conjugations. And I think that's the direction we're going in. But I'm, you know, as you know, Rita commented earlier, this is a smarter, better way to give chemo. And it is working, and it's effective, and it's moving into earlier and earlier lines. And so it's absolutely a benefit for our patients, but there's a lot we can still do.
And, you know, Rita, of course, there's a lot of discussion about mechanisms of resistance to ADCs. And one of the things they brought up, and I meant to ask you about this ahead of time because I didn't know the answer, but I'll just reveal my ignorance to the whole group anyhow, was they were saying that at least in terms of the payload, as Lisa said, right now you're mainly looking or really looking at chemotherapy and, quote, the mechanisms of resistance are similar to the mechanisms of resistance with chemotherapy. And I was trying to remember, what are the resistance mechanisms to chemotherapy, Rita? I couldn't even remember.
Well, I mean, there are different mechanisms based on the different mechanism of action of the chemotherapy. But I think, you know, yes, absolutely, it could be a resistance to the class of chemotherapy that's being delivered. But I think there's also some emerging data that, you know, whether or not you downregulate the antigen being targeted, you know, so I think it's not going to be a one size fits all. It's not going to be resistance to the payload, and that's what's creating resistance to the antibody drug conjugate, because there are some data that suggest you can target SASE after TDXD and vice versa. And they both have topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payloads, albeit different ones, and you can see efficacy. And then, you know, sometimes you don't. And sometimes, you know, you can target different antigens with the same payload and get efficacy. So it's not a chemotherapy or payload resistance mechanism. It's potentially the antigen that is not expressed in enough of, quantity to really engage with the antibody drug conjugate. So, and that's just two things. There are so many other possibilities as well that I think are being explored. And that's just a whole field that's, you know, going to explode. You know, we need to do biopsies after these patients are, you know, resistant to understand, because there are some data that once you get a HER2 targeting ADC, you become resistant, a subset of these patients lose HER2 expression. And, you know, whether or not that might change and you can go back to another HER2 targeting ADC or not, I think remains to be seen. But it's not just going to all be about the payload and efflux pumps and, you know, whatever leads to the resistance of these various agents.
So this is another slide I really liked, using sort of the Lego example in terms of ADCs, with the key components being the, at this point, monoclonal antibody, but I guess the way to target what you're going to try to hit, then the linker, and then, as we've been talking about, the payload. Lisa, this is, I thought, really interesting also, looking at phase 3 trials, not all of them, but a lot of them that are going on right now in ADCs. As always in oncology, we start with advanced metastatic and work our way up. But this is kind of cool because it looks at an overview of breast cancer. The orange are ADC trials with HER2-positive disease. For example, the first-line TDXD trial is something a lot of people are looking forward to see. Then the green ones are triple negative, where you see a lot of IOs plus ADC, again, thinking about the bladder cancer example. And then finally, HER2-positive disease as well. Here, you see all these strategies looking at first-line therapy and then in the localized setting. Any thoughts about these trials and strategies? Are you skeptical or excited, Lisa?
I'm excited. And I think, remember that, you know, these are a mechanism to deliver chemotherapy. And, you know, I think it's instructive, the lessons learned from TDXD, you don't need a lot of the protein target to actually have the antibody drug conjugate work, right? Because it really doesn't need to be an inhibitory antibody. It just needs to basically grab the cell. And so it doesn't surprise me that the effectiveness appears to cross multiple subtypes of cancer, as long as there's a reason to think the protein is at least at low level expressed there. And so that's why you're seeing many of the same drugs being tested in multiple clinical subtypes. You know, I think, listen, the Ascent of the Optimize RD one in the middle, that's, you know, that's one of ours from the Alliance. I mean, we're big fans of this. You know, and the idea is you may move these things into the earlier and earlier setting. If you move them into the curative intense setting, which right now that's where TDM1 lives, you know, that's a, if we have an effectiveness like Catherine, that's going to be a, you know, a big deal and very, very good for our patients.
So this is another series of slides looking at three clinical, really important issues. We heard Dr. Hussein talking about sequencing, but also the biomarker that's being targeted, trying to be more refined about it. It looks like with TDXD, we're starting to get into quantitation and impact. And then, of course, toxicity. Rita, anything you want to say about the potential mechanisms of toxicities? There was a lot of thought, a lot of discussion about the payload determining a lot of the toxicities that you see. But you can also theoretically see that with the antibody as well as the linker. Is there sort of a theme here, Rita?
I mean, even like, for example, the deruxtecan payload, we've seen interstitial lung disease, and it is a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor, but we haven't seen that necessarily with other topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payloads. So there are some unique aspects of the payload, but I think sometimes with some of these deruxtecan payload containing ADCs, we're not seeing as much ILD as we see with, for example, TDXD. So I think there is a component of the antigen that's being targeted and to what degree it's expressed in a variety of different tissues. So I suspect it's both. It's the payload, it's the antigen that's being targeted, and then potentially the stability of the antibody drug conjugate and whether or not the payload's released only once it's taken up by the cell, if it's released extracellularly, that's potentially going to have more, you know, systemic side effects. And then, you know, how potent that payload is, you know, I think all impacts the toxicities.
So there was another slide I forgot to include. I thought I had never heard before about the fact that macrophages in the lung have HER2, and maybe that is in some way tied into the ILD that's seen. But Lisa, you were referring before in terms of the issue of dosing, and here are a number of examples that are given where dosing has affected, particularly tolerability. They were bringing up the issue of gemtuzumab, which actually came off the market and came back on and at a different dose. Any thoughts about practical? You were talking before about dose reduction for tolerability, how you approach that in terms of dose reduction in terms of triple negative breast cancer with ADCs.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of strategies. None of them have been formally tested, right? You know, in terms of, you know, comparing efficacy and tolerability. But I think the optimization strategies that I don't typically use is capping, right? Because again, in this setting, if you're having a drug that's working, you know, saying I'm going to give you 6 cycles and stop doesn't have a, you know, there isn't much of a game plan after that. So I don't typically use that. Response-guided dosing, I think, is a patient-to-patient thing. If you're having a patient with who's having some toxicities and the drug appears to be, you know, working, then sometimes there's a conversation about, like, let's try stepping off a little bit and seeing if we can improve your quality of life. So I think, you know, we got back to this earlier about, you know, dose reductions. And like Rita, dose reduction is, I usually, if all other things are equal, I start at the recommended dose and then go down. But I do it frequently, and I do that more frequently than I would, you know, separating out, changing the schedule, things like that.
So I'm going to move on in a second just to show you a couple other favorites I picked out. I thought this is really interesting, all different new approaches to more specifically identify the particular biomarkers involved. Also, they got into the issue of looking at the payload and how that predicts. We're talking about chemotherapy. Toxicity. This is a really great talk. We had worked with Dr. Mayer before when she was, I think, in Vanderbilt, and she then went into industry. But she gave a great talk on the synergy between industry and academia and, you know, sort of the point there in the middle that everybody's following the science and trying to do the right thing for the patient. But again, really interesting talk about something that you don't hear discussed very much. We don't talk too much about it, which is what's going on in industry. Rita, any thoughts in terms of, again, getting back to triple negative, and we were referring to some of the trials going on, but the use of ADCs in the first line setting, particularly combined with IOs, so particularly in people who have high PD-1 levels.
Yeah. I mean, you've highlighted some trials that are going to read out in the not too distant future here, looking to move up TROP2 targeting ADCs into that frontline metastatic setting. I think, you know, when we think about a lot of our patients with triple negative breast cancer, you know, the majority are not de novo metastatic patients. There are recurrences after early stage therapy. And these are going to be patients who many of them will have had the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. And do I really think another chemotherapy is going to work in that setting? You know, I fight really hard to try to get my patients ADCs in that frontline setting, particularly if they've recurred on their adjuvant pembrolizumab therapy. So I think these are going to be great trials. I suspect they're going to be positive trials. And I think for PD-L1 negative disease, we're going to have ADCs in the frontline setting. And I think for PD-L1 positive disease, we're going to displace chemotherapy and have an ADC potentially with immunotherapy approved. These drugs are already being moved up into the neoadjuvant setting. So I think, you know, we'll very likely have, you know, some approvals coming down the line there too. I mean, obviously not as quick as in the frontline metastatic setting, but there's no doubt in my mind that they're very likely going to displace some of the traditional chemotherapies we use in the early stage setting.
Yeah, the bladder people are all excited about neoadjuvant pembro and fortamab. Can you imagine that? Mm-hmm. So this one popped up as part of, Dr. Sirigliano's talk, and I was like, huh, I haven't thought about that, which is TROP ADCs and HER2-positive disease. Like, why not? But I don't remember hearing about it. This is the so-called Satine-style, Lisa. Pretty simple question here. People who've had previous TDXD, which is going to be like probably everybody soon in the first line, what comes next? And here, SG plus trastuzumab, it kind of makes a lot of sense. I don't know why TROP wouldn't be important with HER2, or is it, Lisa?
No, I mean, TROP2 is, you know, expressed in all clinical subtypes of breast cancer. And so this is a very practical and appropriate study to do. And, you know, I think realistically, the only reason it hasn't been done before is because HER2 is a crowded space. And so there were easier places to develop drugs than in the HER2 space, but this is an obvious direction to go in. And, you know, interestingly, I was in clinic yesterday and a patient I'm about to put on SG who had HER2 positive breast cancer and was treated for several years for that, on her last biopsy, it was HER2 negative. And I said, well, let's try some of the things that we haven't tried before. She said, well, let's add her trastuzumab to SG. she wanted to go on this trial. I have to call and see if she wants to go up to Boston or wherever it is.
Yeah, well, they're used to getting some kind of HER2 therapy continuously, so you can imagine she would say that. So we were talking before about other payloads, which I think is super cool, immune payloads, mm-hmm. PROTAC. You know, I mentioned the program we did with Dr. Hamilton of PROTAC and others coming in the future. This is something else I hadn't heard about, ADCs outside of oncology, neurology, immunology, and infectious disease. So anyhow, I'm pumped about this seminar. Sit down for an hour and a half and watch it. There's a lot there. Let's get back to some of the issues that come up with the patients. And this is one of the most striking of these interviews. This is actually a Rita's patient. And, you know, one of the things that's always interesting is to ask oncology docs and nurses how often they get asked this question: isn't oncology depressing? And listening to this woman's story, I think, is a good example of some of the things that come out in oncology that you never see anywhere in medicine. Here's how this patient with metastatic disease, she's bald and, you know, looks like she's had a lot of therapy, but she's continuing to work. And I found her occupation very interesting.
So I am a Chicago police officer, and I work specifically with families of fallen officers. So I handle Gold Star families for the last 4 years. I've been a police officer for 26, and the last four I've dealt specifically as a family liaison for Gold Star families and fallen officers and officers that die by suicide, as well as any officers that happen to pass away at the police job. I'm currently working through my treatments, but I am also on call. So if somebody gets injured, then I respond. So I'll go to the hospital, I'll meet with the family, And the families know my situation. And I think it just makes me more sympathetic, almost more so, because I can understand we all have a loss. I suffer the loss of the life that I no longer will have. And I grieve for that every day. And these families suffer a loss of not having their loved one. And they reach out to me and I know what they're going through. So we have this great relationship built.
So Rita, this is your patient. I'm curious what your thoughts are when you first encountered her and she told you what she did. I was mentioning in the patient meeting that we did a video and we heard about a patient who was a breast cancer surgeon with metastatic disease who was continuing to do surgery, which is very inspiring. Any comments about this patient, Rita?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really impressive. I just saw her today. She's doing great. She's on therapy. She's on a clinical trial and doing great and continuing to work. So I think, you know, from that standpoint, it's just really impressive. And I think, you know, you have these patients when kind of life hands you lemons, you make lemonade out of it. And I've got a bunch of these inspiring patients who, you know, they take what they're going through and they figure out a way to spin it into something positive. And I mean, that's, you know, that's how you kind of get through things. And so she's doing great and she's got a great attitude and she's continuing to work. And so it's just really impressive.
Lisa?
Yeah. You know, this is why I went into oncology, is because you meet these remarkable people who remind you of the resilience of the human spirit, right? It's, you know, that's a wonderful, wonderful example among many. And like, you know, both of you, you know, I have the pleasure of meeting these people, learning from them and learning how to kind of frame our own existence in a thoughtful way through them.
So another issue that came up in a lot of the patients was the issue of complementary therapies, which you'll hear about in a second, but also something we've had interest in for a long time now, particularly through the programs we do in, for nurses, where there's a lot of interest in this, which is minor children and grandchildren of patients, particularly with metastatic disease, and how they can be managed, some of the special services. Here are some of the comments from the patients about these two issues.
I had some meetings at their schools about it and, you know, made sure I talked to them about it regularly, not trying to hide anything from them, but not trying to scare them either. I was very honest with them and I told them the truth about the diagnosis and the truth about the treatments. And I took a very positive attitude about it. And I never, you know, I never expressed to them that I was afraid or that I didn't expect to survive. But I did want them to know what all was going on and why they had to be at certain places when they would normally be with us. And I think that they do well when they're more informed.
A lot of times when you bring up alternative therapies, you kind of get your, you know, your nose snubbed up and nobody wants to talk about it. I've done a lot of those things on my own just because they're not readily talked about in the mainstream oncology care model, if you will. I do sound therapy. I do yoga as I'm able. I think those are great resources, even if they just help you to feel better, to navigate the side effects of your chemo.
I've been at my cancer center for 5 years. I just this year learned that we have a dietitian. And so I was like, why wasn't that part of the welcome wagoner, you know? Like, it's the same way I hear for a lot of people when it comes to like palliative care and they don't know they have access to it. And a lot of people also confuse it with like hospice and are encouraged like, no, this is all a part of the package and a part of your team throughout your cancer journey.
So Lisa, any thoughts? You know, a lot of times tertiary centers have sophisticated services with a psychologist, et cetera, or even programs specifically aimed at children. You'd always find that in the community, which means that the oncologist, the oncology nurse is going to be dealing with this. Any thoughts about that? You see a lot of younger patients with minor children and you see older patients with grandchildren. Any thoughts about that issue, Lisa?
It's actually a huge issue. And I think, that's something that I think is a gap. There are a lot of, you know, again, the bigger centers tend to have this. We actually have a program called Parenting with Cancer that's specifically around providing the tools on an individual patient basis to help them, you know, with kids in an age appropriate manner. But that's a resource that just isn't available in most places. And the blessing is that that's going multi-center and it's going to go into an app. And so there are people who are trying to do this in the psycho-oncology field to try and make it more accessible. But like so much of what we do, you know, accessibility is a huge issue for many of our patients. And if you have to travel into the big city or to the main academic center in order to access these things, then it's really not providing a true resource. But I think, you know, this is something patients struggle with. You know, the one thing I tell them in addition to referring them to our Parenting with Cancer group is, you know, honesty. And I think one of the patients alluded to this, it goes so much better if you just bring the kids and the grandkids along for the journey. You know, not entirely, but keep them apprised. Otherwise, they invent things that are far worse. And everybody does better if there's, you know, openness to some degree. I think that's the existing data are very strongly in favor of not trying to shield or hide it.
Rita, any thoughts about this issue? And of course, there's a big difference. I think you mentioned you had a patient with anesthesiologist, I think you said, who had kids who were 1, 3, and 5 years old. And obviously, there's a big difference, particularly in the earlier years, about their ability to comprehend this. Mm-hmm. Any reflections on dealing with patients in this situation, Rita?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really tough. And I have to say, you know, I think, you know, the resources that we've got, you know, generally come from the pediatric cancer side. So we use our child life services and social work to help engage with the parents and help them figure out how to tell the kids in an age-appropriate manner what's going on. But for a one-year-old and a three-year-old, they're not going to be able to really comprehend that. So I think it's a challenge. I think it's hard. And I think it's hard to have those conversations with a young 38-year-old patient who's dying of her triple negative breast cancer. Hey, you know, what's going to happen with your kids? Who's going to raise them? And, you know, talk about those things to make sure that the kids are taken care of when, you know, she's not going to be here to help them. But I think, you know, patients also feel empowered to leave memories behind for their kids, to make videos. And, you know, so I think that's also an important thing to think about, you know, and help patients feel empowered to do that as well.
Lisa, also the patients brought up the issue of complementary strategies, whether it's yoga, massage. The number one thing that the patients I talked to asked about was exercise and nutrition. Any thoughts about where, you know, these complementary strategies and also the issue of all, I don't know how often you hear your patient talking about truly alternative therapy that, you know, maybe they're going to switch complete vehicles. Any thoughts about how you think through that? Do you have like a department at North Carolina that deals with integrative medicine, oncology?
We do. And I think the key distinction here is between complementary therapies and alternative therapies. I think complementary therapies, you know, as the patient alluded, you know, yoga, exercise, things like that are generally, you know, really terrific and bring a lot of benefit, if only for the standpoint of the patient's well-being, right? And I always encourage patients, you know, if a particular diet makes you feel better, terrific. It is actually the thing I worry about are the you know, patients being told that you must eat an entirely brown rice diet, otherwise your cancer is going to grow, right? And there's no data to support that, and they're miserable, and et cetera, et cetera. So I try to separate out if it's something that makes you feel good, either physically or emotionally, and it doesn't have a conflict with the therapies, then absolutely do it. But I prefer to know about it. You know, I did have a patient who perforated a colon getting a coffee ground enema, which, as it turns out, doesn't go well with chemotherapy. And, you know, I remember saying, like, what were you thinking? Like, oh, just talk to me if you're thinking of doing this, and we would have had a conversation. So now the alternative path, though, people do use it. I have patients who say, I'm going off to wherever, and I'll be back in a month, and I'm going to try this thing. And I say, okay, there aren't any data, but that's a decision that is up to you. If you want me to look into that particular therapy further, I can tell you it's not considered standard. It hasn't been tested rigorously in the way that we would consider, like, allowing us to feel comfortable with it. But, you know, if that's what you want to do, that's entirely up to you. Just let me know when you want to come back.
Let me just read a comment in the chat room from Natasha, and I really appreciate her putting this in there. As a mom with triple negative breast cancer with four youngest children, age 13, 12, 11, and 8, I think the best thing you can do is delegate and ask for help. Mm. Having open dialogue is so important, and kids are very resilient. This is such a terrible experience for the entire family, but it does make them more empathetic and resilient. Any thoughts, Lisa?
Yeah, I mean, that's 100% right. And again, it gets back to the earliest comment about, you know, your posse and making sure, I think she said, ask for help. Absolutely ask for help. I usually say to patients, like, you've been taking care of everybody else your whole life. Now is a very good time for payback and to figure out who's going to be there and support you and to not be shy about it.
So getting back to our survey, we asked the faculty where they stand in terms of recommendations for complementary strategies. And you can see there's a lot of agreement for exercise and nutrition. I'm a big fan of massage, but I'm not sure necessarily it's always being recommended by the faculty. I want to
I think massage for the doctor. Massage for the doctor. Yes, yeah, that's the way to go.
Right. So, like I mentioned, there wasn't that much that came out at San Antonio. You can check our slide set. This is an interesting paper. Tiffany Traina led a real-world look at the first-line therapy and the issues of IOs and chemotherapy. And there are a bunch of posters looking at real-world experience with ADCs and a lot of the issues that we just talked about. Here's one looking at bone marrow involvement. Time on therapy with something really interesting. But I just want to finish out with one more video related to what I think is an important issue in taking care of all patients with cancer, particularly in this situation.
I feel like you absolutely can't avoid the topic of death and end-of-life planning with this group. Let someone know what a living will is, what an advanced directive is, how to go about filling one out.
I work in a community where most of our patients are in their middle ages, 75 maybe. So I do mention that one of the options is to focus on your symptoms. I won't say we do nothing, but I say we focus on just your symptoms. We don't fight the cancer. And I say it's not wrong if you decide to do that. If you say, I live my life, I enjoyed it, I really don't want to, I don't like doctors, and I want to go to hospitals, I can help you with that too. Patients don't like to feel abandoned, but they like also to make their decision. So I give them that time. Just go home, make sure you talk to your family, think about it. I can tell you 90% of the time they call me back and say, you know what, doc, I really thought about it. I don't want the chemo. Thank you very much for your help. Like, if you can help me get hospice care. So I wonder, when do they mention that, the palliative care or end of life? Do they mention it for every stage 4 or when they feel like really there's nothing else to give the patient? Data is important, but again, I feel like cancer is not just a data disease because every patient is different. It's very rare that you treat two patients the same way, even if they have the same cancer. I feel it is really an art because I can tell you, like, if your patient trusts you and they like you, they do better with the treatment because they trust that everything you tell them is to help them. So they will tolerate side effects, they will follow your guidance, and they will do better. One of the things that I always was surprised with when I see the patient for the first time, when they're diagnosed with cancer, when we finish the visit, a lot of them say, you know, doc, you made me feel better today. I'm like, I just gave you bad news. It's the fear of unknown is what makes them nervous.
Mm. Any final comments, Rita?
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. I would have to say, you know, I probably have the flip type of patient because I have so many young women that I take care of in my practice who don't want to stop therapy, even when, you know, perhaps it's time to stop therapy. So I think, you know, from that standpoint, I have a conversation every time a patient progresses on a therapy about the options. And the option is always, you know, to be very aggressive with symptom and side effect management and perhaps not do therapy, particularly if there's a therapy, you know, they've exhausted their ADCs, and I'm just not sure that we're going to get much mileage out of something else. And so I do have those conversations. Unfortunately, a lot of times patients want to keep, you know, if their performance status is good, then we will keep going as long as they want to keep going. But, you know, when that time comes, when there's really nothing left to try and the performance status is bad, you know, at that point, chemotherapy is going to harm them more than it's going to help them. And being very aggressive and supporting them with best supportive care is the appropriate and best way forward. And that's a really hard conversation to have with a 30-year-old, a 35-year-old, a 40-year-old, much easier with a 75-year-old. But, you know, I think that's why we have to tailor our conversations to patients and what their goals are.
So we could continue this discussion. I wish we could for many hours, but we're going to thank the faculty, Rita and Lisa, so much for working with us today. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Rita. Thanks so much, Lisa.
Thank you, Neil. Good to see you, Lisa.
Bye-bye, guys.